Hello and welcome to the Potential Psychology Podcast. I'm your host, Ellen Jackson, and it's my mission to share the science of human behaviour in a practical, fun and inspiring way. In each podcast episode, I interview an expert from the fields of psychology, well-being, leadership, parenting or high performance. I pick their brain to uncover what they know about living well. What tips do they have for you and I? And I quiz them about how they apply their expertise in their own life. Join me as we discover simple, science-backed ways to live, learn, flourish, and fulfill your potential. My guest today is Dr. Sarah Mackay, an Oxford University-educated neuroscientist who hung up her lab coat 10 years ago to teach, write, and speak about brain health and applied neuroscience. She's the creator of the Neuroscience Academy, an online professional development program created exclusively for professionals working in the health, wellness, education and coaching industries. She hails from New Zealand, lives in Sydney and she naps every day. Sarah's with me to chat about her brand new book, The Women's Brain Book, The Neuroscience of Health, Hormones and Happiness. Welcome, Sarah.
Oh, thank you. It's very exciting to be here.
I'm so excited to have you here.
Yeah.
Now, Before we get on to the book, which I do really, really want to talk about because I want to learn so much more about it, Can you explain exactly what neuroscience is? Because we hear a lot about the neuroscience of this and the neuroscience of that and what our brain tells us about why we do what we do. But what exactly is it that you've studied and that you teach?
Yeah, well, I've certainly become very, very trendy and kind of in the forefront of lots of conversations in the past few years, definitely more so than when I first started studying it many, many years ago. So I went to university to study neuroscience. I have an undergraduate degree, a master's and a PhD in neuroscience, which essentially is one of the sciences. It's the study of the brain and the nervous system. But it's an incredibly broad, incredibly deep topic. And I like to say we've barely scratched the surface of the cortex, but it encompasses everything from looking at the genetic origins of the structure of brain cells or neurons all the way through to perhaps computational modelling of thoughts or behaviours, all the way through to more broad psychological topics and everything in between. It covers every phase of the lifespan from development all the way through to ageing. It's just such a fascinating topic, so relevant to us all because we're all owners and operators of human brains. And so I've certainly been in the field for nearly 25 years now and I feel like I barely know anything. It's just an incredibly exciting a field to be in. And what's great for me is when I first started studying neuroscience, when I was in New Zealand, then I went overseas to, I did my undergraduate degree at Otago. Then I went overseas to do a 4-year master PhD program at Oxford University. And when I went there and I said I was studying neuroscience, people didn't actually know what I was saying. And I know it was not my Kiwi accent because I know a Welshman who had exactly the same problem and people might think I was saying something like Euroscience, like the science of Europe. That wouldn't be the case now. That was 20 years ago. Now, like you say, you can't open a magazine or a newspaper without the neuroscience of this or that, or this is your brain on this or that. So for me, that's very exciting that everyone else is now as interested in my pet subject.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm interested in that. So for me as a psychologist, I suppose we have a concept of the mind as something that we, you know, perhaps, well, drives our behavior, drives our emotions. So that is part of neuroscience. And then the other part in my mind, at least speaking about minds, is this sort of more the brain as an organ, as a structure or set of structures.
Yeah. And I mean, this conversation could very easily then lead down the whole, you know, is there a difference between the mind and the brain? And I guess you could debate that with a philosopher and a mathematician and a neuroscientist and a cognitive psychologist, and you'd never come to a clear understanding of that because we don't really know. I guess the best we've got is the mind emerges from the brain. The mind is kind of what the brain does, I suppose, is one sort of catchphrase that neuroscientists have. But that's what I said. It's such a broad subject that you can be really interested in aspects of mind and consciousness and behavior and thinking, or you can be just very interested in particular molecules or genes or neural pathways or, you know, the much more kind of the neurobiological side of how the brain works and grows and develops. And that was certainly where my interests first lay, very much so in the kind of the biology of the brain itself.
So you started there in that kind of biological type side mm-hmm. of things. Where did that career take you, or what were you working in the years prior to hanging up your lab coat?
Yeah, so well, my PhD thesis was very much focused in on how the connections between neurons, what we would call synapses, wire up during development. So how do neurons or brain cells choose their synaptic partners? Is it innate? Is it a genetic program? Is it biological? Is it nature, you might say? Or are those connections determined by experience, the world around us, or what you might say, nurture? I mean, we don't have that conversation, is it nature or nurture anymore? Certainly what my research showed or supported with the idea that it's a little bit of both. Mm-hmm. So I was very interested in that sort of microscopic level of how do neurons wire up during development. Then when I went in to do my postdoc research, I wanted to work on something a little more applied. I was still very interested in these concepts of what we would now call plasticity, how do neurons change their structure and function in relationship to, you know, environmental events. And I was very, very interested in focusing on something more applied. So I went to work in a spinal cord injuries lab for a few years, which was absolutely fascinating. And I was very interested in why does the brain not recover after injury? Why can people not walk again after a spinal cord injury? And I was interested in that very early inflammatory response to injury. So I did that for a few years, and then I moved into another postdoc lab and worked similar type of question from a biological perspective, but in this instance I was looking at deafness and the hearing pathways in the brain. So yeah, it was always very driven, and I have real passion for the neurobiology of the brain, in particular how do these wiring patterns get determined in response to injury, in response to development, you know, through the lifespan, in response to experience.
And that's interesting, isn't it? Because this notion of neuroplasticity, I know, again, has been very popular, and there's been a lot of discussion about this idea that, you know, our brain is not fixed. Well, I'm not sure stone's the right word to use, but kind of a fixed entity, that it can continue to grow and develop. And I think, you know, there's lots of wonderful stuff that's come out about that, as I understand it. And yet, from your own experience working then in the spinal injuries and in hearing loss, obviously there's a lot that still we don't know or can't be done as yet.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, there's different type. I mean, we tend to use, I find the word neuroplasticity kind of gets waved around like a magic wand. Well, we have neuroplasticity, therefore our brains can change, therefore everything is possible. And there's lots of different types of neuroplasticity and lots of ways that the brain changes its function and its structure in response to what's happening around. So listening to our conversation, synapses will be changing in strength as they sort of tune into what we're saying. Reading a book will be changing the structure of synapses. Anything that you learn or remember from, you know, the previous day in your life, that comes about, that memory is there because the brain has changed. And that is essentially neuroplasticity at one level, at the level of the synapse. When you're looking at things like injury, you're looking at an entirely different type of brain structural change. And sadly, what we do see at this point in time within the central nervous system, the brain and the spinal cord, is we think that the brain cells or the neurons themselves have the capacity or the potential to regenerate, but the local environment prevents them from doing so. So there's a scar form, or the degree of inflammation is such that the neurons, you know, can't sort of fulfill their potential. And it's certainly a very well-researched area, and there's a lot of people with a great passion working on that. So, yeah, there's all different types of plasticity. There's some news that's come out in recent days, which I've been following quite closely. I've been sort of following the conversation for a few years around this topic of neurogenesis, whether our brain produces new neurons all the way through adulthood. And we know that in adult mice and rats and other animals that we study in the lab, absolutely new brain cells or new neurons are born in a particular part of the brain called the hippocampus, which is involved in memory, throughout the lifespan. And the question has always been, well, is this the case in humans? We know it's definitely the case in children and perhaps in adolescents, But the case really is out at the moment about whether that happens in adult humans. There has been some evidence in favour. More recent evidence suggests perhaps not. Now, lots of people are finding this quite sad news. I've seen a lot of commentary around, oh gosh, it's what a shame we don't have adult new neurons being born. But I mean, whether it happens or not, we're still in exactly the same personal position we've all been. We know that there are certain types of plasticity which carry on. Whether or not adult neurogenesis happens is really by the by. We still know that the kind of the fundamentals for brain health. Perhaps we just don't understand the mechanisms by which they act in the brain.
So the human experience doesn't change knowing this does or doesn't happen. It's just understanding those mechanisms.
No. Yeah, absolutely not. We can still learn and grow and change, and it may be harder the older we get, and certain experiences may be, or certain types of brain change may be easier depending on the person and the context and their life history, who they're working with, etc. We just don't really understand the mechanisms yet. And I think that's so exciting and fun about science, is just watching the kind of, you know, the iterative process and how opinions kind of swing one way or another. And I just think that's just so engaging and fun to watch.
I can understand that completely. So what took you from that to writing about women's brains and your wonderful tagline for the book? So the Women's Brain Book, The Neuroscience of Health, Hormones and Happiness.
Yeah, well, there was about 10 years in between the, you know, the work in the lab and now. But yeah, I did hang up my lab coat, as you say. I mean, I loved neuroscience, and I think you can tell that by talking to me, but I got very frustrated with academia and applying for grants, and was it a real decision point in my career? Do I want to stay in the lab, or do I want to try my hand at something different? And I'd always had a hankering for science communications, and I just liked talking about the brain. I loved working in the lab, but I liked talking about it just as much, and just thought, you know, I was looking for a career change. It took a lot of torment and soul searching to get there. But so for the last 10 years, I've run my own business as a freelance science writer, consultant, you know, speaker. I've done all kinds of things within that space, and that was kind of how we got to know each other. I started blogging about neuroscience. I have to admit, I have never been one of those people that's had a book inside them. I know a lot of people say they've had a book inside them. I had a PhD thesis inside me. It was like I pulled that out, like pulling out a tooth. But I had been approached over the years by various publishers, you know, said, would you like to publish a book? And my answer was always no. I didn't really feel like I had a good idea. And I think if you're going to write a book, I don't think that you should have to over-explain the idea of your book to someone. And I just simply didn't have a very good idea. And I was approached by a publisher for the very last time, who has since become my agent. She got in touch and she said, oh, look, I think there's room for another brain book in the Australian space, and quite intrigued me. And we decided to meet and have a conversation. And she said to me, oh, what have you ever written? And at that point, I still didn't have any ideas. She said, well, what have you ever written that, you know, has kind of engaged people the most or has intrigued you the most? And I said, well, I once wrote this article about menopause and brain fog, which is this kind of colloquial term for feeling a bit fuzzy and perhaps lacking in concentration or memory. And I found out that, you know, a lot of women mistake this brain fog going through menopause for the early signs of dementia, but they're very, very scared to seek help for that. And I wrote an article, and it had this enormous response of women writing to me saying, oh, that's me. I feel so relieved, and thank you so much. And I thought, well, you know, maybe there's a book idea in that. And then I thought, well, you know, I never really thought about menopause, because at the time I was 40. Menopause was something I thought my mum did with her friends once. And then I thought, oh, well, what about baby brain? You know, I've heard a lot of people talk about you feel quite fuzzy and forgetful when you're pregnant or when you're an early mother, you know, in early stages of motherhood. Oh, gosh, I wonder what the sort of neurobiology is behind that. And then I honestly had one of those aha moments. I thought, I have never thought about all of the experiences that I've had through my childhood, girlhood, and as a woman. I've had 25 years experience as neuroscience, but I've never really kind of thought about the two together. And I thought, well, I wonder what happens to our brain during the menstrual cycle. I wonder what happens to our brain going through puberty. I wonder what does happen to our brain when we're pregnant. And what about aging? I know that there's a gender gap in rates of depression and anxiety. And all of these questions just flooded into my mind that I had never, ever considered, which was a little bit embarrassing because I was a neuroscientist, been the owner and operator of a woman's brain my entire life, and the two had never come together. So there was this neatly encapsulated idea for a book. So I sat down and wrote the chapter outline. Honestly, Alan, it took me 10 minutes. This is not a normal, this does not normally happen to most people.
There was a book in you after all.
There was a book in me after all. I just didn't know. And really, it follows a chronological through the lifespan. Look, it starts in the womb and ends in the tomb. So each chapter of the book looks at a different phase of life, from in utero through childhood, puberty, menstrual cycle, teenage years. I look at the gender gap and depression, pregnancy, motherhood, menopause and old age. And at each of these chapters, I just wrote a list of questions to answer that I didn't know the answer to. I thought, what happens to our brain when we go on the pill? Does the pill make us depressed or does it make us happy? What happens when you go on HRT? You know, why do women live longer than men, but they're more likely to develop Alzheimer's and dementia? So many questions. And so off I went.
Wow. I need to read it now. You've just said all those questions that I hadn't actually thought about either, but they are so pertinent and so relevant. Again, I mean, for me, I suppose as a woman now in my mid-40s, so relatively recent experience of the baby thing, but also now entering those kind of, I suppose, probably perimenopausal, menopausal years.
I know. It's a bit frightening how quickly that happens for those of us who may have had babies in our sort of mid-30s.
Indeed.
Then suddenly you've got kids at primary school and then you're facing down menopause, which seems like something so far and off. Actually, when I was writing the book, one of the decisions was, where was I going to put the chapter on anxiety and depression? And I decided I didn't want to put it between motherhood and menopause because I thought that's a bit depressing. There must be something else between. I put it after the teenage years.
Wonderful. Yes, you're right. I mean, we have compressed things. I think that's probably a whole other podcast episode for me as well about this notion of compressing a whole period of life experience that used to be two separate things and seems to be merging more into one.
Yeah.
So amongst all of that, and I can imagine there's not a single answer to this question because so many exciting things that you've just discussed there, but amongst all of that, what do you think was the most fascinating fact or insight or topic that you uncovered while answering these questions and doing the no doubt enormous amount of research that went into the book?
Yeah, it is so hard because it's like asking which is my favourite child. There's probably three or four. I've got two children and a dog and I couldn't choose between them. There was sort of three or four. I guess I naively went in from this very neurobiological perspective thinking, oh, this will be a book about biology and it will be very much around hormones and neuroendocrinology and it'll all be about estrogen and its impact on the brain. And I very quickly realized, and it was fascinating to come to this realization. I got a bit woke. The book contract actually came in the day Trump was elected. So I spent 2017 writing a book about the female brain, thinking it was going to be very much about neurobiology, but realizing it wasn't so much about sex. It was about gender and the experiences of girlhood and womanhood. Because of course, as I said at the very beginning of this podcast, it isn't just about nature and biology. It's about experiences that shape our brain, and in turn our brain then shapes the experiences we have. So I guess one of the perhaps naively I went in thinking this will be a book about biology, but it ended up being a book about a whole lot more. And for each phase of life, whether it be childhood or puberty or motherhood, but sure, biology plays a part, but so does our connection with other people and the experiences we have, our past, you know, sort of the society and culture, and all of that feeds into, you know, our expectations about our health or the thoughts or the feelings that we may have, our mindsets, our psychology. And I wasn't quite expecting the book to, at each life stage, to encompass all of those and how each of those would have such an impact. So I very quickly had to get up to speed, because it was 2017, with a little bit of sort of the feminist literature around the female brain and biology and that influence. So that was a real learning curve for me. It was very exciting and it was a great, 2017, what a year to be doing that in. So that was perhaps one surprise. I guess, and again, this probably relates to that. I suppose for me, the two studies which almost surprised me the most, which were the most counterintuitive, one was around, I was interested in what happens to the brain over the course of the menstrual cycle. And I was looking at, does our capacity to think and reason change over the course of the menstrual cycle? It doesn't. Okay. Do our emotions flux? Well, I mean, it's a bit more complicated than that, but do our emotions sort of flux and wane over the course of the menstrual cycle? And, well, yes, they kind of do, but a lot of the studies were very kind of people in the lab looking at very granular measures of emotional memory or something. I said, oh, well, I'll look at PMS, premenstrual tension, premenstrual syndrome. That'll be easy. That'll be a really great way to look at how emotions change before your period. Well, it turned out it was very, very hard to find any consensus on PMS. I managed to narrow down the percentage of women who experience PMS symptoms somewhere between 5 and 95%, depending on which country you were looking at. So somewhere between hardly anyone and almost everyone. Depends whether you're talking about emotional or physical. When I started looking at the emotional and psychological kind of changes, the literature got really interesting. And there was one study in particular, and I spoke to the researcher. Her name's Sarah Romans. She's a psychiatrist in New Zealand, specialises in women's health. And she was finding, she had all of the women were coming into a clinic and saying, oh, I have terrible PMS and my depression is worse at this point in my cycle. And she was a little bit sceptical. So she designed a study whereby there was a whole host of women recruited, and they were charting their mood and daily life. Each day they were prompted by an app or something that popped up on their phone to chart their mood and various other life stresses and experiences they were having. They were never told that the study was about PMS, and this is key. So they were not told it was about PMS, and they were also given, which many studies do not do, a mood valence scale that was included positive emotions and negative emotions. So they weren't just asked if they felt sad or grumpy or weepy or annoyed with their husband or tired. They were also asked if they felt creative and upbeat and energetic and positive, et cetera, et cetera. So it was positive and negative mood. And when all of the data was gathered from, there was about nearly 400 women over a number of different cycles, they were also prompted day of cycle. There was no relationship between day of cycle and mood. Only about 1 in 20 women had a genuine emotional kind of low point in the week before their period, which contrasts to studies that are done when you tell women you are looking at PMS. It's almost like there's this huge cultural expectation around feeling that way before your period.
Wow.
But when women are not told that, when they're not kind of primed that this is what the study was about, instead, mood was far more likely to vary depending on how the social support structures women had around them, how sort of socially supported they felt. And as a psychologist, you would know that that's absolute key. How stressed they felt about life in general and their physical health. And that was incredibly surprising. So when I spoke to, and I went in with no real kind of preconceived ideas about this, although I do have to admit I've never suffered from PMS. So I kind of thought, well, this validates my experience, but I did say to the psychiatrist, well, then how do you say this to women? Because many women may feel that's invalidating. Science is saying, no, you don't feel this way. And she said, well, I just have to collect some data on what's going on in your life. And perhaps we need to just start looking beyond our reproductive capacity, beyond our hormones. We're not on this hormonal roller coaster we can't get off every month. Some people are, but most of us, there's all kinds of things going on in our lives. Perhaps, you know, other points in the month, you may be busy blaming your husband or the kids or your stress at work, and we're primed to think at this point in the month, oh, well, I'll blame my hormones.
It's a correlationary thing, isn't it? That correlation is not causation.
So
this, we have our period, therefore they must be related, but maybe not.
So that kind of came through, that type of theme came out. As I say, hormones are just one voice in the crowd. And that came through again during the pregnancy. I was looking at baby brain, this concept of baby brain. Again, when women are brought into the lab and very careful studies are done of memory and reasoning and whatnot, there's no difference before they're pregnant, during pregnancy and after pregnancy when they're sitting in the lab doing studies of attentional memory or whatnot, whereas most women will believe there is. And even careful studies that have been done where the women are then showed their results, look, your scores are the same as they were before you were pregnant, the women are still disbelieving.
Mm.
And so again, well, we're not denying any woman's personal experience here. It's just about going, well, what else is going on? You know, is there, you know, we can't just kind of fall back on our hormones. And our hormonal kind of signature during pregnancy is very much, we have buckets of estrogen, more estrogen during pregnancy than you'll be exposed to the rest of your lifetime. And estrogen is a cognitive enhancer. and all other animals, it makes them smarter, it makes them more wily, it makes them, you know, rats find their way through a maze better because they have to find food for their young. It's beneficial in every way.
Which makes evolutionary sense, doesn't it? You know, that we should be at our best because we have this role, you know, this burgeoning role in life that's going to require us to protect and care for and raise another creature.
Absolutely. Yeah. And one of the, there was another study, I suppose one of the most striking studies was in terms of structural changes in the brain. The greatest structural changes that are seen beyond childhood and adolescence are during pregnancy. And there's thinning of the cortex, which is kind of the wrinkly grey wrapping around the outside of the brain. There's thinning of the cortex, certain regions of cortex during pregnancy, which may sound like, you know, thinning may sound like degeneration, but it's actually refinement. The brain's kind of becoming leaner and more refined, and it's specifically in the regions that are associated with empathy and recognizing the emotions in others, which is absolutely key as a mother. So much so, the changes are so significant in women that computers were able to, they could use artificial intelligence to predict whether a woman had had a baby within the last couple of years or not, purely based on her brain scans. And what was really neat about this brain scan study was, as a control, they also looked at the brains of the fathers. So it was kind of a husband and wife pair, just to see whether it was the experience of parenting that changed the women's brains. And it wasn't. It was definitely the actual biological process of pregnancy. And again, that study didn't find any cognitive changes in these women. So there was a lot of studies like that that I found, which were completely intriguing and I think incredibly empowering for women.
Yeah.
It may be hard to start changing some of that story. It's not about saying you don't feel this way or denying that kind of experience. It's about, well, let's just kind of take a bit of a different approach to thinking about our health, because our expectations of our health and well-being play a huge part in health and well-being itself.
Mm, and that's wonderful for me as a psychologist, I suppose. It's like there's a bit of myth-busting going on there and everything you found. But for me as a psychologist, because we can't, when I talk about to people about attaining their goals or making changes in their lives, and we talk about focusing on, you know, what is it you can't change and what can you change? Well, you can't change your biology. You can't change your hormonal response to timing or experience. Yeah, you can't change your brain. What you can change is how you think about it, and you can change how you're living those days. You know, if you're feeling in these ways, what is it you can change? Yeah. Well, do you get out and socialize with girlfriends or make those connections? Do you go for a walk and exercise? Do you what is it that you need to do that is within your control that is going to make that a better experience?
Yeah, and absolutely. And time and time again, whether it was infancy, childhood, you know, the huge transitions young people go through, girls and boys, and they go through puberty and adolescence and motherhood and men and old age, it was, you know, stress or toxic stress is damaging, and it does impact our health and it impacts our mental health and it makes life more difficult. But the best buffer against stress is social connection. And sometimes it's just having one person, you know, that can be there to care. There was another really interesting study. I mean, I could talk for hours about all of this. It came out of Dunedin in New Zealand again. It's a Dunedin longitudinal study, which has tracked about 1,000 people who were born in the 1970s. And they've looked at them every couple of years since and done, they do every study from looking at their teeth through to,
I know the study.
They're criminal, criminal
record. I'll link to it in the show notes. It's fascinating.
And I spoke to the head of that study, and Richie Poulton, who was probably my most favourite scientist to speak to. He's an absolute gentleman. Gosh, he was an amazing man. And they found up until middle age, so all of the people in that study, the same age as you and me, Alan, they're all in their mid-40s now, there was only about 17% of people up until middle age had remained completely mentally healthy. So there was the majority of people had at least one episode of some type of mental health problem, whether it be depression or anxiety, whether it be something even mild depression, anxiety. There were the people who are in more serious, you know, perhaps had schizophrenia or bipolar disorder, or perhaps had post-traumatic stress disorder. But it was almost, and Richie's kind of take on that was, we need to start thinking about mental health problems like how we think about a bad case of the flu or a kidney stone or a broken leg. Sometimes it happens and it's normal and it's okay and it's recoverable. And it was another thing. It's not over-diagnosing or over-medicalizing mental health problems rather reducing the stigma and helping people realise these things are normal.
Yeah.
And what can we do to support people through them? And again, the biggest way that you can be supported through something like that is with those strong social support networks. They just kind of love wins. That was another message that came out so strongly.
Yeah, wonderful. And it's interesting how so many different fields, I suppose. I mean, you're coming at it from a neuroscientific perspective and me thinking about the same situation from a psychologist, because this is something I talk about in workplaces when I'm talking about mental health and wellbeing at work, is that, you know, one in five of us will experience some form of what we'd call a mental health difficulty, but is most likely a mild to moderate form of anxiety or depression. And that kind of blows people's minds, because I tend to say, look, you know, okay, so there's 15 of us in the room, you know, that's three of us in this room at any given point.
At any given point, exactly. That's the thing, isn't it?
At any given point.
Yeah, and I think it's really important for people to realise that it's just kind of the human condition. And it's not to, again, say it doesn't matter. It's about, well, let's just treat it like we would treat a broken leg, right? You're in this situation. What can we do to help you recover?
Which sort of leads me to my next question, because in the title of your book, you talk about that lovely tagline of health, hormones and happiness. What is it that you learned from your research and from your own knowledge and experience as a neuroscientist about happiness? And what would be your tips, do you think, for listeners if they want to improve their brain health in such a way that it leads to improvement in their happiness and well-being?
Yeah, well, I kind of painted myself into a bit of a corner there with my like kind of fondness for alliteration, because I nearly got to the end of the book and I was like, I haven't talked about happiness. I really believe in that expectations matter, and the more kind of knowledge, you know, this whole knowledge is power, but the more knowledge we kind of have about what affects mood and what affects our brain health, the more kind of buttresses we can put in place, the better off we're going to be. And sure, things happen in life, and sure, sometimes our biology kind of gets in the way and we may suffer some type of illness, or aging happens. No matter how much you don't want it to, you know, life kind of rolls on. I think all of those ideas fit into what builds a happy life. One of my favorite chapters was the very last chapter. I was looking at kind of aging and longevity. And I describe in a reasonable amount of detail the story of the world's oldest living woman, who's a French woman called Jeanne Calmon. My agent is French and she has told me how to pronounce her name correctly. She's been coaching me. And, you know, she was this kind of wily, sharp, amazing lady, even when she was kind of, you know, 118, 119, and a whole host of psychologists went in and neurologists and did all of these tests on her when she was 118, 119, 120, just sort of, everyone just really wants to know the secrets of a long, happy life. Mm. And I mean, it was not really a secret there. This lady was a real character. She made a lot of jokes. She said that laughter was important. But she also was an incredibly fit and healthy lady. She lived on the second story of a walk-up apartment building until she was in her 90s. She rode her bike. She did actually smoke cigarettes, but she had a real fondness for chocolate. She was incredibly socially engaged. And I think, you know, she definitely had she must have had a biological propensity to longevity. But as she said, and she had been interviewed so many times about her secrets to longevity and happiness, there was no secret. It was just enjoy, laugh, you know, stand up for yourself. And I guess, again, exercise, social connection, all of these things are in there. And I don't think that there is any secret. It is just those kind of those basics.
Yeah, which absolutely parallels what we know in the pos-psych field about what creates a flourishing life, that we need good relationships, engagement with what we do, physical exercise. Mm. She probably slept well.
She may have even had afternoon naps.
She may have. Which was exactly what I was, that was a perfect segue, because I was going to ask you about that. You are an advocate for naps. In fact, you are a nap taker yourself.
I am. I'm a regular napper. It's right about nap time now.
And so from a scientific point of view, what's the benefit of taking a nap?
Well, for me, I kind of delved into the science behind it, because I'd always got to that mid-afternoon slump and struggled to stay awake. and spent 2 or 3 hours, particularly when I was not self-employed, when I was a student, and just spent hours, you know, fighting that urge to nap in the afternoon. And it was only when I started working for myself from home and I could indulge that urge, I very quickly discovered I really only needed sort of 15 or 20 minutes. And it was just incredibly pleasant. It made me feel so much better. It gave me a second day. I felt more emotionally put together afterwards. And instead of fighting this urge, like there was something wrong about napping or something indulgent or something naughty, I realized how good I felt about it. So I did sort of start looking into the research and realized how many nappers there are out there in the world and the various benefits that have been shown up. I mean, we all know that we all need a good night's sleep, but for some of us, we just have this sort of biological dip in the middle of the afternoon. It has nothing to do with what you ate for lunch. It doesn't necessarily have much to do with how much sleep you have at night. In fact, the vast majority of people I speak to are regular nappers, sleep very well at night as well. It very rarely, regular, like professional nappers, it very rarely disrupts their sleep at night, because we all do a few things. That is, we nap when we feel the urge, but we don't ever nap for longer than sort of 20, 25 minutes. If you nap longer than that, you go into deep sleep, and then that disrupts all of your sleep cycles later on. It smooths your emotions. It aids in memory. So lots of studies have been done looking at giving people a nap and looking at verbal recall or maze navigation. And then there's a lot of artists and creative types use it as a way of problem solving or gaining creative insights, because it's that kind of, you go into that sort of dreamy other world where thoughts sort of bubble to the surface that may not have been there when you're cognitively engaged. Same as what might happen if you have a shower. It's one of those few places where you go where you are completely disengaged from what's going on around you.
Which, just that notion of not fighting it for me, and it's interesting again, you know, because I quite often when I run a daytime workshop and you're coming back after lunch, and then it's like, okay, how am I going to get these people to, especially that kind of 2:30, 3 o'clock mark?
Yep.
It's like you can see it. I can observe that attention is waning and they're not quite with it. And so I get them to get up and move around. Unfortunately, napping's not that practical in that scenario.
It's not practical. It's not, unfortunately.
Yeah. But I do think this, you know, for me, again, working with people around whatever it might be, achieving their goals or making changes in their lives, often what we talk about is, what is it that you're fighting that perhaps you don't need to fight? And that just that language that you used of, you know, because you do, you feel like you're fighting. It's like, no, I must push through, I must. And then that question of, well, why? Why push through, you know?
Absolutely. And you could spend 2 hours pushing against it and feeling dreadful and achieving nothing. Or you could spend 20 minutes napping, and then you've got an hour 40 where you feel great afterwards.
Yeah.
It makes so much sense to me. And it just feels so good. And you don't have to learn how to do it. You don't need to download an app. You don't need to, you know, go to a course. If you feel, if your body knows what to do.
Yep. Yeah.
Free. It's just, lots. Some people seem to think it's a little bit self-indulgent. Well, it is. But, you know.
What's wrong with that?
Yeah, exactly. You know, life's tough enough. Give yourself a break.
Wonderful. And so where else can people find you? I'm going to put all the details. I'll put the details of the book, some of the other studies and things that you've mentioned. I'll put all of that in the show notes. Mm-hmm. Where else can people find you if they want to learn more about what it is you do and what you share? You've also had a TED Talk, so I'll link to that too.
Yep, that's on Afternoon Naps. Sure. So I've got a blog called yourbrainhealth.com.au where I blog about neuroscience. I'm running a series at the moment on gut-brain axis because people are very interested in that. I'm working with a specialist neuroscientist in Melbourne who's helping me. We're kind of writing those articles together. So there's that blog, and there is my professional development program, which is the Neuroscience Academy. So the link for that is theneuroacademy.com. And I run that twice a year. It's a 10-week online course that I run a couple of times a year, and you get 20 hours, you get certification, et cetera, afterwards. And then I'm on social media, Twitter, @ Sarah M. Mackay. It's probably the best way to connect with me. I'm all over the place.
Fantastic. You're all out there over the internet.
All over the interwebs.
I will link to all of that. Mm. And most importantly, the book is published on the 27th of March.
Yep. So here in Australia, New Zealand, the Woman's Brain book, the 27th of March. E-book in various places globally. However, the book is also getting published in the UK, I think the 16th of July. However, it's got an entirely different name and cover over there.
Yes.
It's called Demystifying the Female Brain, a neuroscientist explores health hormones and happiness over there. So the publisher decided that it would have a different, just like J.K. Rowling and the Harry Potter series.
Of course.
It would have a different title and cover in different countries just to make promoting it interesting. So it really depends kind of where you are in the world, but certainly Australia and New Zealand, it'll be out in a couple of weeks and all good bookstores, and it should be available online. And then, yeah.
I know it is available already for pre-order on Booktopia.
Yes, my husband told me that. I feel strange about Googling myself, but he told me that's indeed the case. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Sarah. That has just been so interesting. I'm definitely getting a copy of the book. In fact, I think I might be buying it for my sister and mother and maybe a few others as well. So much to learn and explore and understand. And I think for me, that notion that in order to, you know, maybe the biggest tip in terms of that happiness piece is around informing ourselves, you know, just understanding more about what it is that we are owners and operators of and what impact it does have on us and what we can control and what we can't, and using that knowledge to our advantage.
Absolutely. That's some, you summed it up better than me. So I'll write all that down.
I really, really appreciate your time today. Best of luck with it. I know you're about to embark on a bit of a book tour and publicity tour. So best of luck with that. We feel very privileged that you're kicking that off with the Potential Psychology podcast today. And I will make sure that all our listeners know exactly where to find you in our show notes.
Oh, thank you so much for inviting me. It's a very exciting time. So it's an honor to chat to you.
Wonderful. And we'll have you back on again at some stage, I'm sure, because I think we've just skimmed the surface of many, many things that we could discuss. Thank you, Sarah. Isn't Sarah amazing? I hope you enjoyed this episode as much as I did. I'm off to order my copy of the Women's Brain book and maybe some extra copies for family and friends. As we do for every guest, we've put together links to Sarah's website, TED Talk, online program, the Neuroscience Academy, her book and her social media profiles. You can also download Sarah's tips from the episode in a fabulous free PDF, yours to keep. You'll find all of this in the show notes for this episode. Head to potential.com.au/podcast. While you're on the website, don't forget to sign up to my regular newsletter so that you can keep up to date with new podcast guests and the latest goings on at Potential HQ. If you're enjoying the podcast, please let me and others know by giving it a rating in iTunes. This will spread the word about the great guests I'm chatting to and give more people the opportunity to fulfil their potential. I will be back very soon with episode 7. I'll be talking to Dr. Tess Crawley, clinical psychologist and keen mentor to her fellow mental health professionals. Tess became aware of how difficult it seems to be for clinicians to seek support for their own well-being, especially as their businesses grow and they become responsible for managing other people. It'll be a great discussion with plenty of tips for all of us keen to balance our well-being with our professional growth and the other important roles that we play in life. I'm looking forward to it, and I hope you are too.